Okay, so yeah, so this lecture, lecture 11, will be about the renormalization group and the renormalization group flow in the standard model and what that's about. Introduction to the idea of effective field theory, the running of the couplings in the standard model, and application to various things, including the physics of QCD, asymptotic safety, quark confinement, a lot of great stuff. I'm going to try to pack so much stuff in there that by the end you're going to be like a kernel of popcorn. And if I've done my job correctly, at the end you'll just, you know. But before that, I just want to finish the last slide of the previous lecture. So this is, you know, going through these great patterns in the standard model, SU5 and SPIN10 we've met already. Here's one more that I just wanted to briefly introduce you to. This is the Hadi Salam picture based on SU4 times SU2 left times SU2 right. So what's the idea here? Well, basically, again, the standard model is a subgroup. SU3 times SU2 times U1 is a subgroup. SU3 is a subgroup of this SU4. SU2 in the standard model is actually just this SU2 again, and then U1 hypercharge is, well, we'll see, it's kind of embedded in both of these bits. So let me explain what I mean. So the idea here is that we saw there was this, you know, the best cleaning up of the standard model table took it from a 3x6 table down to a 1x1 table. Well, this one doesn't get that far, but it still gives a nice, it brings out a nice aspect of the standard model, and it's related to the other two, so we want to just briefly understand that. So here we have here the table looks as follows. It's pretty simple. There's just two rows now. There's the left-handed quark field, which now, instead of being a triplet with three components, with three colors, is a quadruplet under SU4 with four colors. And then there's the corresponding right-handed quark field, which again, instead of being a triplet under SU3 with three colors, is a quadruplet with four colors. And then, just like before, the left-handed fermions transformed as doublets under SU2. Well, they still do here, and then they're not going to transform at all under SU2 right. But now with the right-handed fields, it's going to be the opposite. Now they transform as doublets under SU2 right, but don't transform under SU2 left. Just like the right-handed fields in the standard model didn't transform under SU2 left. And so somehow the idea here is that we've taken, you know, if you think of the original standard model table, you know, remember there were six lines. There were the upper three that were quarks, Q left, U right, D right. And then the bottom three were analogous leptons, L left, nu right, E right. And, you know, you may have noticed that there was this kind of parallel between the upper three lines and the lower three lines, where, for example, if you just took all the, you just took the upper three lines, you removed the SU3 charge, so you changed the triplet representation to a singlet representation, and then you just took the hypercharges and subtracted 2/3, that all the first three lines just become the second three lines, you know? If you think back or look back at the table, you know, you'll see there's that relationship. And so in the first three lines, there was this relationship where Q left broke into U left and D left, and that then paired with U right and D right. And analogously in the next line, L left broke into nu left and E left, and that paired with nu right and E right after symmetry breaking. So there are these parallels, and the idea is to try to incorporate, this symmetry pattern incorporates those parallels or attempts to explain them. So basically what happens is we group together the leptons. We treat them as the fourth color of quarks. So there's three colors of quarks, and then, well, now the fourth color of quark is the lepton, corresponding lepton field, and the idea is that they look different to us because in the low energy world, or for whatever reason, the full SU4 symmetry has been broken down to SU3 times U1. So that's one aspect of the theory is explaining the parallel between leptons and quarks in the standard model. The other aspect is that it simultaneously treats another funny aspect of the standard model, which is that, you know, in the standard model is a chiral theory. For some reason, the left-handed fields behave one way and the right-handed fields behave the other way. So for some reason, the left-handed fields all transform as doublets under SU2 and the right-hand fields don't. And then there's no left-right symmetry between them. Whereas this theory is left-right symmetric. It's not left-right symmetric, but there are these sort of parallels between the left and right-handed fermions, that after spontaneous symmetry breaking, the left-handed quark breaks up into two guys, which then are exactly parallel to their right-handed counterparts, and the left-handed lepton breaks up into two guys that are parallel to its right-handed counterparts. So here that is explained by saying in the full theory, the theory really is left-right symmetric. So the left-handed guys, you can see that in this table. The left-handed guys do transform under SU2 left, don't transform under SU2 right, whereas the right-handed guys do transform under SU2 right and don't transform under SU2 left. And the reason it looks asymmetric at low energies between left and right is that this symmetry has been broken at low energies. Something like that. Okay, so that's the brief idea. If we write this in our old notation, these two representations look like this, and their charge conjugate representations would look like this. And just being very schematic, here in this line, remember we went to this trouble of thinking about how to take the SU3 times SU2 times U1 element and embed it in SU5. Well, if you try to think about very analogously about how to embed this element into a 4x4 unitary matrix, 2x2 unitary matrix, and a 2x2 unitary matrix. In the SU5 case, there was a sort of unique embedding. In this case, actually, it's not unique, but it's not unique. The SU3 matrix, well, there's only one place that can go. It only fits in a 4x4 matrix, so it has to sort of go in the 3x3 block of the 4x4 matrix, and then this SU2 matrix, well, it can only go in either of these SU2s here. So if you think about it. Let's put it there. Now the U1, though, if you ask how can I now stick in the U1 so that everybody still has determinant one, well, there's this freedom you'll find that you can put p powers of it here and -3p powers of it here, and q powers of it here and -q powers of it here. And that'll do the trick for any integers p and q. So that's the extra freedom you have here to choose those integers. But it turns out if you want to get the standard model out by restricting to the subgroup, you can choose those integers to be these two. And then by a very analogous calculation, which I won't go through, but which I recommend going through as another very enjoyable exercise, you'll see that the representation of this theory, the full quark, the full complement of guys, the full complement of fields, do indeed reduce to the standard model representation, just like happened in the SU5 case or the spin-10 case. It's not as impressive a pattern as the other two, but it is another aspect of the story, and it's really a part of the spin-10 pattern. So I just want to explain that connection. So how is it related to spin-10 or SO10 grand unified story, which is the sort of best one? It turns out we haven't talked about Dynkin diagrams in this class, but there's this way of classifying. There's this nice little diagrammatic notation for classifying all the different Lie groups in Lie algebras called Dynkin diagrams. There are these four infinite families of Dynkin diagrams that each have normal meanings, but when you, they're infinite families, they can be arbitrarily long, those Dynkin diagrams. But in the smallest cases where there's only a one or two or three nodes in the diagram, you'll see there's degeneracy. So multiple different groups actually have the same Dynkin diagram, and that's secretly telling you that Dynkin diagram knows something, which is actually there's isomorphisms between some of those small groups. So there's two famous isomorphisms you notice here if you look at the Dynkin diagrams. One is that the Lie algebra for spin 4, or in other words, the double cover of SO4. So the Lie algebra of SO4, same thing, is actually equal to, isomorphic to the Lie algebra of SU2 times SU2. So this actually is actually SO4 there at the level of the Lie algebra. Whereas spin 6, or SO6, is actually isomorphic to SU4. So that's here. So another way to write this thing, another way to write this Lie algebra, is that it's spin 4, or SO4, plus this is actually slightly wrong. There should be a mod Z2 here, but anyway, never mind. This would be more correct. What I should have written here is actually SO4 times SO6 is a subgroup of SO10. Anyway, meanwhile, spin 4 times spin 6 mod Z2 is a subgroup of spin 10. But what I'm trying to say here is that, okay, spin 10 is all rotations of 10-dimensional Euclidean space. Well, you can break that up into, you could imagine finding a subgroup where you just split, you only look at the rotations that only rotate one of the four-dimensional subspace, and the rotations that only rotate the orthogonal six-dimensional subspace, but without mixing the 4D space and the 6D space. Those would be block diagonal 4x4 and 6x6 with 6x6 blocks like this, and that's an easy way to see why SO4 times SO6 fits inside SO10, or spin 10 more correctly. And so together with these isomorphisms, that's sort of why this group, which is secretly spin 4 times spin 6, is a subgroup of spin 10. And so to make a long story short, the summary is that there is the grand pattern in the standard model seems to be governed most fully by spin 10, but it has two maximal subgroups. One is SU5, and one is the Patti Salam subgroup, each of which bring out kind of more clearly some sub-aspect of that grander pattern. And then there's a very nice review article, I should mention, beautiful review article about this whole topic by John Baez and his former student John Huerta, about the mathematics of grand unification, or the algebra of grand unification, maybe it's called. And you know, one of the things that they nicely show there is that then exactly the intersection of these two subgroups is precisely the standard model gauge group. So in some sense, the standard model is the structure that sits within spin 10 and somehow exhibits both of these sub-patterns. So that's all I wanted to say. Yeah.
Can you go back to the previous thing? Mm-hmm. In order to generate SU2R, we need three parameters and three generators.
Mm-hmm.
Seems that we can generate it using just the alpha.
So here I'm embedding a subgroup, just like with the SU5 story. I'm taking a subgroup, so this is not the most general element of the group. This is only a 12-dimensional subgroup of this full 15 plus 3 plus 21-dimensional group. So this is you won't get the most general element of the group here, because, for example, you're not getting if you look at the last matrix, you're not getting the most general SU2 matrix. You're only getting this one-dimensional subgroup of the final SU2, right?
But physically, I used to think of SU2R as causing isospin for right-handed fermions.
Mm-hmm.
SU2L is a complete SU2, but SU2R is in some sense not complete.
Right. Well, the idea would be that in the full symmetry group, it would be complete. Exactly, they would be exactly analogous. So somehow in the full, if you saw this full symmetry in nature, then just like you see a symmetry that rotates new left into E left, you would see a symmetry that rotates new right into E right. But the idea is that because it's spontaneously broken, because this one is spontaneously broken down to this subgroup, this would be the grand unified theory explanation of it. This would be the physical grand unified picture. Because there's some other higher energy Higgs boson with a higher analog of our Higgs boson, instead of, if we call our Higgs boson Higgs left, there's another Higgs right. When it got its VEV, for some reason it was much bigger than the VEV of the Higgs left, and it broke down. The only subgroup that left that VEV invariant was this U1 subgroup. And so that's why at low energy, where we only see these transformations, it looks like the right-handed leptons don't have an isospin acting on them, or the left-handed leptons. The full theory, they both would be on an equal foot. Is that clear? Okay, so, okay. Good. Let's go on to now back to the renormalization group. So what's it all about? Well, so the first thing is that there's a standard trick that field theorists do, which is they redefine the path integral in Euclidean space. And I just want to explain what's going on there, starting from a simpler example, which is this Riemann conjecture you've probably heard about. This is the most famous problem in mathematics now that Weyl's solved the proved Fermat-Less theorem. So what's the idea? Well, there's this function, the Riemann zeta function, which I think was actually maybe introduced by Euler, but Riemann did a famous thing with it. So that's the sum from n equals 1 to infinity of 1 over n to the s. Okay, so this is just a function of this parameter s, which is determining what the exponent is in each term. So that's called the Riemann zeta function. And you know, what's the idea? Well, the thing which I'm trying to say is analogous here is that, okay, you probably know from complex analysis that, you know, an amazing thing about an analytic function, remember, an analytic function, by the way, just means an analytic or a meromorphic function in complex analysis. By that I just mean basically that it only depends on S, can be written purely in terms of, as a function of the complex variable S, it can be written purely in terms of S without needing to use S bar. Okay, so it's just purely a function of S, not a function of S bar, and then that correspondingly means that it can be infinitely differentiated, etc. So that property of being complex analytic is somehow very restrictive. It's very rigid on how it imposes this great rigidity on how the function can change in the complex plane. So, you know, if I just told you the function, the values of the function at some tiny little region here, for example, along the real axis, and then I told you it was an analytic function, well, oh, that suddenly there's actually a unique way to extend that information, that function, all around the complex plane, that extension is uniquely determined by the little bit of data I gave you here. It's very, very rigid, so it can't independently choose what to do, you know, over here once I've told you what it does over here. So in particular, this Riemann said, okay, so this sum actually only converges over here in the blue hatched region. So that's the part of the complex plane where the real part of S is greater than 1. But I can use that analytic continuation property to figure out, still, even though the sum only converges over here, I can figure out what the function is everywhere else in the complex plane, and I find that it has a whole series of zeros along the negative real axis, and I find it has a pole at s equals 1. But then, famously, the thing which he found, although it's still conjectured to be true, not proven, that's the Riemann conjecture, is that it also has a whole series of other weird zeros that all lie along the line s real part of s equals to 1/2. And that's what people have been trying to prove, because a lot of other things in mathematics, and in particular properties of the prime numbers, rely on that fact being true. So the thing which is analogous to physics is just that, you know, also in physics we have this situation where we have a basic sum that we want to compute. In that case, it's the Feynman path integral. But the region where that function converges, where that sum converges, you know, it's not actually the region we're interested in studying. So we have to then, by analytic continuation, analytically continue that that sum, that function, over to the region where we actually do want to study. So in this case, so I've explained this case. So the analog in the physics case is that, you know, we want to study physics along the real-time axis, but the path integral is an oscillatory integral there that doesn't, that is very ill-defined. On the other hand, it becomes much better defined as a integral along the imaginary time axis, but that's not where we want to study it. But so a common approach in field theory is to define the path integral up there, compute it up there, and then take the results and you get in Euclidean field theory and analytically continue them to get the results in the real time direction. So here's that idea a little bit in more detail. So here's sort of in kind of formal language, a formal summary of what quantum field theorists do is that they define this object, the generating functional Z or the partition function, which is some function of an external source now. And what is it? Well, it's the integral of e to the I times the action that you want to study, action for your fields, coupled to that source, and you sum e to the I s of phi and j over all possible configurations d phi. So maybe I should have talked about this picture first, actually. So you know, Feynman's path integral approach to quantum mechanics says, okay, if I as applied to quantum field theory, says, okay, if I have some initial slice here at some initial time t initial, and I know the field configuration on that initial time slice, so I know phi of x and ti, and then I also know what I want it to be on the final time slice, so phi of x and t final, then if I want to know the amplitude to go from this initial configuration to this final configuration, I'm supposed to sum e to the I s of phi over all configurations phi that interpolate between my initial slice and my final slice. Somehow this is in this figure, you know, the blue lines and the green lines are supposed to represent two different, you know, schematically two different possible configurations that are interpolating. For each of those, I would compute the action and sum e to the I s of phi over all possible such interpolating configurations. And then anyway, so and that formally is encoded in this object here, and by manipulating this object, I can extract anything I want to know about the field theory, including scattering amplitudes or many other things. Okay, so again, the problem though is that the thing I'm summing up here, the integrand, is highly oscillatory. So it's like, you know, the sum, if I want to do the sum, you know, 1 minus 1 plus 1 minus 1 plus 1 for infinity, you know, what is that equal to? Well, it looks like it's just not a convergent series. I mean, depending on where I truncate the series, I'll either get 0 or 1, and it's not like it's approaching some sort of limit or something like that. So this integral is a lot like that. It's just terribly defined. Now, even the Euclidean integral apparently is also terribly defined, mathematicians would say, but it's better defined, and so physicists switch to that. By physicist standards, it's well defined. So what's the trick? So the idea is that we switch attention from thinking about evolving between two slices which are separated in the real time t direction. Instead, we define a new time coordinate tau, which is related to the original time t by minus I. T is equal to minus I tau. Okay, so if this is the complex t plane here, t points along the real axis, tau points down the imaginary axis. So this is called a Wick rotation. And you know, so here I've just, as an example, let's look at the action for for a normal Klein-Gordon scalar field. So here's the kinetic term, phi dot squared term, the minus grad phi squared term, and then minus the potential, and then here's some coupling to a source. And so now if I just make this substitution and rewrite the whole thing in terms of tau, well, you can check that what happens is that if I pull an overall I out front here, then now every term, you know, in this original expression, first of all, notice that there was some terms that were positive, some terms that were negative, some terms, you know, that were sort of, so there were some terms that are positive and some terms that were negative. I guess you would say as long as V is bounded below, both these terms are negative. But when we go to Euclidean, well, now they're all strictly positive. So one just defines this thing. If you pull out the I, the rest of this thing is defined as the so-called Euclidean action. And so now, you know, if you put that, if you rewrite the our partition function, if you rewrite the path integral in terms of that, well, this was originally e to the is, so it's now e to the minus s Euclidean, because the two i's give a minus. And so now, because this it's e to the minus something strictly positive, well, that's a much more convergent integral. That this SE but if it's strictly positive, then there's some configurations where it's zero. Those give the biggest contributions. That's where the integrand is biggest. But then away from those configurations, as the fields fluctuate more or get further away from the minimum of the potential, SE just gets positive in all directions away from those biggest points. And so e to the minus SE exponentially dies away. And so it looks like we're getting a nice convergent integral, which just has some peaks and then exponential decay away from those. That seems like something we can actually integrate. Okay, so that's the idea. That's why physicists work with the Euclidean path integral. It's analogous to working in this region over here where the zeta function is well defined. Okay, good. So in that language, we can then say Ken Wilson's way of thinking about the path integral, his sort of idea of the renormalization group and effective field theory. So here's our, okay, so sorry, for just notational simplicity, I'm just going to drop the sub e now, and I'm going to drop the sub e for Euclidean, and I'm going to drop the j also. So here's my original path integral. So let's first think about what exactly, this is, you know, this says integrate, this is the name for the measure of the integral over all possible paths of phi. Okay, but let's think about what that really is. Well, we can take phi and we can Fourier transform it and write it as a sum over all possible four momenta of the Fourier amplitude of each momenta, phi twiddle of p times the Fourier times the plane wave e to the ipx. And so if we do that, well, then this integral over all possible paths, well, that's really just the integral over all possible values of phi twiddle of p for all possible values of p. In other words, this thing is really more explicitly this thing. It's just the integral over all possible values of phi twiddle at the momentum p1 times the integral of all possible times the integral of all possible values of phi twiddle at phi of p2, et cetera, for all possible values of p. So that's what we're doing here. We're taking, or the measure is really the product over all possible values of p times of d phi twiddle at that p. Okay, good. So now, so far so good. So now Wilson's great idea is he says, okay, let's think, instead of thinking about this, so this path integral that includes all configurations, so it includes all values of p, no matter how high. The action which appears in this path integral is called the bare action. But that path integral is very wild. I mean, it's very, you know, you can see here we're doing, you know, you learn first in calculus to do a one-dimensional integral over dx, and then you learn to do dx and dy, and then, you know, but here we're not even going up to a, you know, countable infinity. Now it's not even like we're doing an integral over dx1 times dx2 times dot 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 forever. You know, this is some uncountable infinity of p's that we're including in the measure here. So it's a huge, humongous integral, and in particular, it includes, you know, modes of arbitrarily high p. So it includes configurations that are, you know, arbitrarily wiggly and crazy. So he says, okay, let's think about a path integral that only includes less crazy configurations. We'll only consider path integral over, well, instead of the full measure d phi, the integral over all paths, we'll consider d phi lambda, which means d phi lambda is, that's the path integral over all configurations that only include Fourier modes up to some maximum value of p less than lambda. We're only going to integrate over those Fourier modes. We're going to just set all the higher Fourier modes above lambda to zero. Remember, we're working in Euclidean space now. So in Lorentzian space, the Fourier modes could be positive or negative, or, you know, they could, p squared could have positive or negative or zero norm. But in Euclidean space, they're all positive. So if we just put a cutoff, p squared is less than lambda squared, that restricts us to some ball of momenta around the origin in Euclidean space, in momentum space. So we'll just think about field configurations phi lambda, which are only built from the Fourier modes phi twiddle of p for p less than lambda, and so this path integral is just going to be over those sorts of more mild, not arbitrarily rapidly wiggling configurations. And then the idea is, okay, what if we could find another function s lambda of lambda phi? What if we could find another function S sub lambda of this new smoothed field phi sub lambda, such that when we do this integral, you know, remember we're trying to, for example, do the integral between some initial surface here and some final surface here. Sorry for the terrible drawing, and we're trying to, you know, look at all these interpolating configurations. Sorry, I'm trying to draw this. We're trying to do the integral over some. So we give some initial condition and some final condition. We want to compute this integral between those. But we want to do that integral not using these arbitrarily wild configurations. We want to use these milder ones. And the question is, can we find a new function S sub lambda of our milder configurations so that these two calculations would give the same answer? That they actually give the same integral. So if we could, we would call this thing the Wilsonian effective action S sub lambda, corresponding to the original bare action, but smoothed over the scale, but with the cutoff lambda. Okay, so. So to think more about what happens when we do that, so his next good idea is to think, instead of trying to think directly about the relationship between this guy and this guy, he says let's try to think about the relationship between S lambda and S at some nearby lambda plus delta lambda, some very nearby energy scale, and see how S lambda changes as we change the cutoff lambda, and then we can imagine sending the cutoff lambda to infinity and seeing how we would get back to the original bare action. To think about how S lambda and nearby lambda are related, well, let's take our field. Our field phi lambda here, okay. So that's this field consisting of Fourier modes up to lambda, and I'm going to break that now into the part of the field phi lambda prime coming from the modes that are below an even lower cutoff lambda prime. So lambda prime is a little bit lower than lambda, and so if I look at all the Fourier modes here, well, I can break them into the ones. Part of the integral coming from the momentum modes below lambda prime, and then the rest. Okay, this is the rest of the integral. So this is just a way to rewrite the an integral. You can always break it up into two sections. And I'm just going to call this guy phi lambda prime, because of course it's defined exactly the same way phi lambda was, but with the new cutoff lambda prime. And I'm going to call the rest, the field defined by this, the rest of the integral, I'll just call that for convenience chi. That's another field. Okay, and then if you think about the measure, well, you know, again, if you think about the measure as the product up here, this product, you know, then again, I'm just going to split that product, that infinite product of terms. I'm going to split that into a part which is the integral over the Fourier modes that are below lambda prime, the lower cutoff, and then the integral over the rest of the Fourier modes, which are in between the two cutoffs. I'm also going to do, it'll also be convenient to use the following notation. So let's write, so I have my actual, I have the actual function s lambda here of phi lambda. So first of all, phi lambda is just phi lambda prime plus chi. So this thing is equal to this thing. This is s lambda. This is the action that I want at scale lambda, but I've just taken the argument and rewritten it in this using this equation. But now I want to rewrite that as follows. I'm going to rewrite that as s lambda, the same lambda as before, not lambda prime, s lambda, but evaluated at the new, more smooth field, phi lambda prime. So now this term is not equal to this term on the right side. And then I'm just going to define s hat lambda to be whatever it needs to be. It's going to be whatever function of both variables it needs to be to make these two sides equal. So in other words, s hat lambda is just defined as the difference between s lambda evaluated at the real field and s lambda evaluated at the more smooth field. So I do that because then I can now take this expression that I wanted to consider and I can rewrite it in terms of these new expressions. So first of all, I can take the measure and split it up into the d phi lambda and d phi lambda prime and d chi part, just like I did here. And then I can take the e to the minus s lambda term up here and rewrite it as e to the minus s lambda of phi prime, phi of lambda prime, and then my e to the minus s hat term. But you know, now if you look at this, I can, because this term doesn't depend on chi, I can just, you know, just like in an ordinary integration, I can take this integral, the integral d chi, and pass it through here. I'm making a mess here, but anyway, so hopefully you're following. Are you following? Is it a yeah?
Question about splitting the measure, because it looks like you're saying d of phi lambda prime plus chi is equal to d phi lambda prime times d chi.
Yes, that is that, and the reason that is to see why that is true. If you think about the definition of what those two fields are, so basically all I'm doing, the reason it's, yeah, I agree. That is kind of confusing. But the reason it's true, if you think about it, is that okay, remember, the way we're defining the sum here is precisely by splitting up some subset of the Fourier amplitudes will be the ones that contribute to this guy, and the other subset, the other disjoint subset of the amplitudes are the ones that will contribute to this guy. But now if I look up at the definition of d of phi lambda, that is just a product of all of those Fourier amplitudes. So, but you know, the product is just this commutative product of d phi one, d phi of p one, d phi of p two, d phi of p three. Imagine the case there were only three p's: d phi one, d phi two, and d phi p three, and that this guy was just defined as the field that came from summing up the d phi ones times, you know, take Fourier transforming just using the d phi one and d phi two. And this guy was defined as just the Fourier amplitude that came from summing just the field that came from doing the including the Fourier amplitude d phi 3. Well, then I could split this product d phi 1, d phi 2, and d phi 3 into d phi 1, d phi 2, which would then be all the Fourier amplitudes involved in one of the fields, and d phi and times d phi 3, because this thing is, it's just coming. I'm just rewriting this product as a new product. I'm just splitting the terms in the product into two parts, the ones that correspond to one field and the ones that correspond to the other field. If you see what I mean. It's not that I'm taking. That's why we went to Fourier space, is to avoid those cross terms. You see. So what I mean to say is that. What I mean to say is that in Fourier space, no, there are not. That's the thing. Because, again, to take a simple case, phi of k1 times d phi of k2. Well, let's take that even simpler case. Let's suppose we initially had a field which only depended on, which was just a sum. Let's say a field. First, we had a field that was only a sum of these two wave vectors, the exponentials corresponding to these two wave vectors. But it was an arbitrary sum, and we were going to path integrate by just integrating over the amplitudes of those two wave vectors. Now I say no. I want to just re-express that problem in a different way. I'm going to define the first field as just being the first plane wave, and the second field as just being made of the second plane wave. But now if I do the integral, it's still the same integral I did before. It's still this product of d phi 1 and d phi 2. You see what I mean? So it's just a kind of clever way to decompose things so that you don't get cross. That's sort of good question. I'm realizing this whole thing is probably too confusing to take. Like many of these things, it's going to be probably better if you make sure to go through these more slowly on your own after the lecture. But the bottom line is that this, if we just plug in all of these things, all these expressions we've defined, then this initial expression we wanted to consider is equivalent to this one. But then by just moving d of chi through first term, you'll see that we're left with this d lambda prime times something. And what is that something? Well, if you just compare these two expressions, you'll see that something, the integrand in the new d phi lambda prime integral, is just equal to the old e to the minus s lambda of phi lambda prime times the integral of d chi times this e to the minus s hat business. But you know, once we, so this is called integrating out chi. So you would say that what we're doing here is we're integrating out intermediate momentum modes by integrating out this field chi. We're taking this quote unquote action, and we're now just doing the path integral over this field chi, which only sort of contains the intermediate Fourier modes. And that integral is equal to whatever it's equal to, but the bottom line is that it only depends now on phi lambda prime because we've integrated over chi. So we now have a product of two factors, each of which only depend on phi lambda prime, and so this new action, e to the minus s at lambda prime, this is the effect. Because this expression is now perfectly parallel to the original expression, but with lambda replaced by lambda prime, we have derived an expression for the new effective action, e to the minus s lambda prime, at the new lower scale. E to the minus s lambda prime at the new lower scale is equal to the original action, ES lambda at the higher scale, but evaluated at the smoothed field. And then there's a little bit of shift. There's a little bit of extra contribution to the action coming from the integral over the intermediate modes chi. That's given by whatever expression we get, ES sub lambda, delta S sub lambda, from doing this integral. And so this fact that the new action is not just the same as the old action, but has a little shift, so that if we imagine infinitesimally changing lambda, that the action infinitesimally flows, that's called the so-called renormalization group flow. Okay? And another thing Wilson understood was that, you know, the fields flow, the action flows, but you know, if the theory is built from some fields with some symmetries, and all the terms in the action are just all the terms you can think of built from those fields and with those symmetries, much like we were doing when we were constructing the standard model. Well, that will be true at this scale, and it'll be true at the old scale lambda, and it'll also be true at the neighboring scale lambda prime. So really, all that will happen as you change between those two scales, the same symmetries will allow the same terms and same fields to be present. All that will happen is that the coupling constants that appear at lambda prime and the coupling constants that appear in the action at lambda will be slightly different from one another. They will flow. So the coupling constants will flow, and that's called the RG flow of the individual couplings. So let's talk about that briefly. So in Feynman diagram language, there's another way to think about that. So here, for example, is the diagram that defines the coupling constant of electromagnetism, or of some gauge field. Okay, so well, yeah, electromagnetism, let's say. So here we have an electron going by and emitting a photon, and the amplitude associated with that defines the electromagnetic gauge coupling G. But now the idea is that, well, you know, if we don't have infinitely precise vision, you know, in this diagram it looks like they're meeting at an actual honest to God, you know, point, infinitesimal point in space-time. But I mean, you know, if we're going to do this business where we cut off at scale capital lambda, it's as if we no longer have, you know, infinitely precise vision. We can't see down to arbitrarily small wavelengths. We have some sort of, this is sort of blurred out. We have blurry vision. We can't see with infinitely fine resolution. And so could it be that if we kind of zoomed in on this vertex, that we would see that there was secretly, you know, some stuff going on there? So here I've written just a diagram that has the same external legs, so it looks the same far away from the vertex, but there's more stuff going on near the vertex. Well, according to quantum mechanics, according to the Feynman path integral, you know, if that stuff could be there, you know, the idea is you have to integrate over it. It's that the path integral is over all possible configurations that you know, are compatible with whatever boundaries you're interested in. So in this case, you know, here we have these external legs. But if our vision is blurry, it could be that stuff like this is going on, and so we have to. The effective coupling constant for someone with blurry vision will be a sum of this diagram, but also all diagrams like this that are compatible with their blurry vision. So as a consequence, the actual effective coupling constant G they see will depend on how blurry their vision is. So that's somehow physically why their effective coupling constant will run, why there is this renormalization group effect. And so, you know, so quantum field theorists love to calculate the running of their quantum field theories. And so here's just a few bits of notation to introduce before I tell you about what goes on in the standard model. Oh man, the finale here is going to be so grand, I can't even stand it. There's just going to be so much lead up and then so much payoff right in 5 minutes, my God. Okay, so this is the so-called fine structure constant. You know, normally in electromagnetism, the fine structure constant is the electric charge squared divided by 4 pi. Famously, it's 1 over 137 in electromagnetism. But for any gauge group in the standard model, we take its coupling squared divided by 4 pi and conventionally define that to be the fine structure constant for that, for the alpha for that gauge coupling. And then for any coupling, but in particular for these alphas, the beta function of that coupling is defined to be, take that alpha and differentiate it with respect to lambda, and then to get something with the same units as alpha, we multiply by lambda. So we take d alpha d lambda times lambda, or in other words, we take d alpha d log lambda, if you think about it. So that's for any coupling constant, d coupling constant d log lambda, the blurring scale, is called the beta function of that coupling constant. And so quantum field theorists love to calculate these beta functions for different couplings. And so in particular for the gauge couplings in a Yang-Mills theory, the leading order beta function looks like this, some number bi over 2 pi times alpha I squared. And so bi is just a constant. So for example, for U1 in the standard model, it turns out to just be 41 over 10. For SU2, it turns out to be minus 19 over 6. For B3, minus 7. So if you just look at this differential equation, this equation d alpha d log lambda is equal to this. Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, so yeah, good question. So when I say, very good question. Should have been clearer about that. So these parameters in the standard here we're looking at various. So what are we doing here? We're looking at parameters in the Lagrangian, like alpha, okay, which are coupling constants that appear in front of terms in the Lagrangian. They are constants in spacetime. So they're not fields. They're a constant everywhere in spacetime. But what we're saying is that they do, if you imagine blurring your vision by different amounts, if you imagine cutting off the path integral at different places, a la the previous slide, that the values of those coupling constants corresponding to the same physics do change. So they're not constants with respect to the blurring scale lambda. And so what we're doing is the beta function measures what their velocity is, how they change with as you change the blurring scale. Okay, so if you just take the definition here of beta, this is a good exercise to do, but I won't have time to do it in real time. And you set it equal to, you know, a constant times alpha squared. That's a differential equation you can solve. You just put d beta over alpha. You put d alpha over alpha squared on the left side. You move, and then you have the bi times 2 pi times d log lambda on the other side, and you integrate. And you'll find that the integral, you can just, you know, solve that differential equation. And the result is that the coupling, the inverse 1 over the alpha that you get at some scale is equal to 1 over the alpha you have at another scale minus this coefficient, bi over 2 pi, which is just a constant, times the log of the ratio of those two scales, lambda over mz. So here, you know, for example, we can measure the alpha i's, the three alpha i's, at the scale corresponding to the mass of the z boson. Those are three measured values. But then we can use the renormalization group flow to ask what would the values of the coupling constants be at any other value, lambda, using this equation. And so, for example, we're in the standard model, we measure alpha 1, alpha 2, and alpha 3 at the z mass to be these numbers. And then we know from a QFT calculation, from calculating diagrams like this, we know the values of these three constants. And then we can ask, you know, if we take the three gauge couplings here at the Z mass and ask what happens to them as we run them to higher energy scales, well, a famous calculation is that they run like this, and they almost meet. They almost become equal to one another at a very high scale called the gut scale, which is about 10 to the 16 GeV. Maybe I write it somewhere else. Well, there's actually an interesting story, which is that in the 70s when they did this, these measurements were not as precise back then. It looked like they all three exactly met at a gut scale of 10 to the 15 GeV. And at the time, that seemed like extremely strong evidence that the SU5 grand unified Q theory was correct, because they were just they thought, oh, this is great evidence that SU5 grand unification is correct, and the unified theory must be up at this scale where the coupling constants unify. As observations got better, we now know that they don't actually unify directly. So let's see. I want to give at least some punchline, as always. I'm not going to make it to the final slide. I want to give at least one punchline before we stop, which is that, okay, if you just take this expression for the solution we had for alpha as a function of scale, and just take one over both sides, so just kind of simplify that expression, rewrite it. Now it looks like this. Okay, so this is how the alpha itself appears rather than alpha inverse. And if you look at this expression, you'll see an interesting thing, which is that how it depends, how it behaves, well, it depends a lot on whether bi is positive or negative. If bi is positive, then if I measure alpha I at the z mass and then ask how it changes as I run lambda to higher energies, well, if bi is positive, you see that if I go to sufficiently high energies here, this number gets sufficiently big and positive. This will cancel this, and the denominator will become zero. So if bi is positive, like it is for the U1 gauge field, then at sufficiently high energies, alpha I actually diverges to infinity at a finite energy, given by this number. Oops, that should say mz, not the W mass. But mz. So that is called the Landau pole. That fact that at a finite energy you can the coupling constant can seem to diverge, or at least perturbation theory predicts that it diverges. So the perturbation theory is breaking down at that point. That's called a Landau pole. So the an interesting thing about the standard model, very important point, is that the standard model could have had all sorts of Landau poles that occurred at, you know, we measured down at the electroweak scale. It could have been that when we took those coupling constants and you used QFT to run them to higher scales, we had Landau poles appearing left and right. Different coupling constants could have diverged in this way. That's what you might have naturally expected. In fact, the observed fact is now that if the standard model has any Landau poles, they're all up above the Planck scale. So actually all the coupling constants remain finite as far as we can run them, all the way up to the Planck scale, and we can't really run them beyond that because we don't know enough quantum gravity to know how to run beyond that. So as far as our theoretical horizon can take us, there are no Landau poles in the standard model. It appears to be compatible all the way up to the Planck scale. To me, that's a very fundamental hint. But anyway, it's not 100% clear what that means, and different people give different importance to that hint. Okay, what about if bi is negative, like it is for SU2 and SU3, crucially in particular for SU3, well then what happens is that if I measure the value of the coupling constant at the z scale and ask what happens as it go to higher energies, now you'll see what happens is just that the denominator just gets bigger and bigger, so the coupling constant alpha of lambda just gets smaller and smaller. So now alpha goes to zero for SU3 and SU2 as the energy gets very high. So that is called asymptotic freedom. And so that's the quarks. Well, yeah, so there's a final slide then about all sorts of interesting stuff about QCD, but it's going to have to wait for QCD is the prime example of an asymptotically free theory. But rather than rushing it because it's too great, we're going to do it at the beginning of next time, in keeping with the tradition where I mean, there's two key traditions, I would say. One is that I erase my own slides is the first thing. And then the second one is that I begin with what should have been the last slide of the previous lecture. So we'll keep up those two traditions, I'm sure, next time. But yeah, that's it. Any questions? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So then you said that
QED does have a positive beta function. Now, it only really makes sense to run that beta function until you get up to the electroweak scale. And at that point, you don't get a Landau pole. And then above that, the sensible couplings are G1, G2, and G3. G1 now, is like QED, has a positive coefficient. So in principle, if you could run it up to infinite energy, it would develop a Landau pole. But the point is there's a bunch of other couplings in the standard model that if you could run them up to infinite energy using the naive flat space QFT techniques, neglecting gravity, they would eventually develop Landau poles. But the kind of interesting fact is that actually in the standard model, all those coefficients are small enough that you would have to run them up way above the Planck scale before they actually. But then you can't trust the running once you get past the Planck scale. So, or whatever, or in any case, this running is not the correct running once you get past the Planck scale. And so in practice, the statement is that as far as we know, there are no Landau poles in the standard.
One more question.
Yeah.
In case of the animals, the BI load is
negative.
Mm-hmm. So it depends about what. Mm-hmm. But that's true also for SU2, but the B horizontal
not. Yeah. That's because, well, we'll talk about that next time. That's because the SU3 gauge coupling, we'll see, if you're negative, then now you hit your Landau pole by going down in energy. So for QCD, you already hit that Landau pole at a few hundred MeV. You already hit it at a microscopic scale. So that's why, in that case, the Landau pole is telling you perturbation theory for QED, QCD, SU3 does break down at some energy just below the Z mass. It breaks down at the QCD scale. For the electroweak, it would eventually. Okay, the issue is that if you took the naive perturbative calculation seriously, then the electroweak coupling would similarly have a Landau pole, but it's at quite large lengths. Because electroweak is a lot weaker, because the coupling constant is a lot smaller, its Landau pole is at a much lower energy scale corresponding to a length scale. I don't know how long it is, but it's bigger. It's bigger than the radius of the Earth. You know, it's pretty big. It's like an astronomical length scale. So even if you took the perturbative calculation perfectly seriously, you would only get this divergence at much larger length scales. But then also you shouldn't take it that seriously once you get that low, because among other things, QCD has gotten so strongly coupled at that point that it infects the perturbative calculations of the electroweak scale enough to disrupt that prediction. So now that you mentioned it, I'm not 100% sure what. But the bottom line is that it's the putative. Now that you mention it, I'm interested. That's an interesting question. There is this naive prediction that there's an analog of QCD confinement for SU2 at very low energies. Excuse me. Sorry. The fact that electroweak symmetry breaks ends up disrupting that confinement, because the only actual gauge coupling left to run below the electroweak scale in the electroweak sector is U1. This running of SU2 times U1 actually no longer makes sense below the electroweak. So that's really what it is. That below the electroweak scale, the remaining gauge couplings are U1 and electromagnetism and SU3, and SU3 is the one that has runs into a Landau pole. I guess basically, if there wasn't spontaneous symmetry breaking, if the Higgs potential had been like this, then I think it would be that SU2 would also have a confinement transition, or in any case, it would become strongly coupled. Perturbation theory would break down at something like the size of the solar system. But there wouldn't be a solar system, because there would be none of the particles would have masses. It would be a very different world, yeah. But fun to think about. Yeah.
Can you go back to the slide where you introduce the normalization?
Yeah. Oops.